Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 231 featuring Mike Hill, an absolutely amazing guest, fantastic person. He is done all kinds of different work and done lots of different areas. Concept artist, working on helping pitch, brand design of shows, lots of different things of that nature. To all those different levels, he's done things. He's worked on Blade Runner 2049, Love, Death, and Robots, Game of Thrones, and a lot more. But one of the other things that he started doing more recently is he got very interested in film analysis through psychology and mythology and different areas like that. And he started doing lectures on that subject. He did a fantastic one that I absolutely love called on Jurassic Park and specifically contrasting it to Jurassic World. And we actually start to get into that in this podcast for quite a bit. And it was just absolutely amazing. I love the way he thinks about things, so much so that I said, you know what, this hits very close to home, because as you guys know, in the early days of CG Garage, we used to do, Dan Thron and I were part of the Martini Giant podcast, which has now spun off into its own podcast. If you guys are interested, go check out Martini Giant. It's something I really enjoy. So also, if you like this Mike Hill podcast and you really liked some of the stuff that he's talked about on Jurassic Park, tune in very, very soon. There will be Mike Hill came on to Martini Giant, and we actually talked about a movie there. We talked about Thunderbolt and Lightfoot, which is a film that we really enjoyed talking about too. So really cool to have Mike on. Really great that he was able to come to CG Garage and Martini Giant and spend so much time with us and share his views, because they are absolutely fantastic. I'm going to say for announcements, there's some news. There's some new stuff. I hope you guys are going to SIGGRAPH, because we will be at SIGGRAPH for sure. We are doing what used to be called V-Ray Days, but now we're just calling it Total Chaos. We're brand shooting from our Total Chaos conference, and now we're just doing Total Chaos at SIGGRAPH 2019. And if you guys want to know more about that, go to chaosgroup.com/SIGGRAPH. /SIGGRAPH 2019 and go check it out over there. We will be there on July 30th and 31st. And we have all the details that are in there. So go check out all the speakers that will be there and all of the different events that are happening for that, for what's going on. If you want to go this year, you will need to have a showroom floor pass, which you can get for free if you go to our website, and again, chaosgroup.com/SIGGRAPH2019, and we have a promo code where you guys can get your badges. So I would love to see you at SIGGRAPH. I will be there the whole time. Could be good to see you guys, and come on by. Come on, check out Total Chaos at SIGGRAPH 2019. All right, guys. Hopefully you enjoy this awesome, awesome podcast with Mr. Mike Hill.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
What are you doing in town? Can you tell us what you're doing in town?
What am I doing in town? I'm traveling just right in general. So I'm moving around nomadically. Uh-huh. But I was invited out for two things. I was invited to come and talk at SIARC downtown.
I love SIARC. Yep.
Yeah. So Liam Young, one of the course runners there.
Yeah. He's a great guy.
Yeah. He's a really nice guy. And mm-hmm. we've been talking via email for years, but never kind of made anything of it.
I met him through Ben West.
I don't know Ben West.
Ben is over at Frame Story. He's a director over there, but he also teaches a class with Liam at SIARC.
Oh, okay.
And so I did a guest lecture there at one point to talk about virtual production and stuff. But yeah, really nice guy, really knowledgeable and really into architecture and filmmaking, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. He's really enthusiastic about both, which is great and knowledgeable.
Right.
And he's just a really nice guy. Uh-huh. So it makes it easy.
Absolutely.
Know? So he got in contact. He emailed me years ago, and it was a weird coincidence, but at some point I was downtown and I passed by SIARC, mm-hmm. and then I was like, SIARC, I know this. And then I kind of went and checked my email, and it slipped past, you know, through the filter.
Mm-hmm.
And then I emailed back and said, oh, you know, I've coincidentally just passed your school.
Right.
So, you know, how about a coffee kind of thing? And then we just did a spontaneous talk the next day with his students.
Oh, great.
And this was maybe about 6-7 months ago.
Okay.
And then he emailed me kind of about a month ago and asked if I wanted to pop by LA and talk at SIARC and just give a quick 25-minute talk.
Sure.
So I did that. And then I also went to, Travis Bourbeau invited me to do a lecture at CGMA.
Okay.
So I kind of just did one after the other.
Couple talks. Nice.
And then weirdly things just ballooned while I was here. I have clients here and studios that I work with and people I know. I used to live here. So
right.
I lived here for like a year. Because we bumped into each other once or twice.
Yeah,
I was at Blur.
As at Blur, but also I think the other place we met is at THU.
Yes.
Right.
Well, yeah, that was our meeting was quite an interesting one.
Yes, we got stuck in the elevator.
Yeah,
together.
It was a potentially final destination moment.
yep.
Yeah, the highlight of that night was the point when the elevator was clearly sliding downwards and that guy squeezed himself through.
That
I thought that we were going to see a decapitation.
Yeah, so people realize we were coming out of, we were deciding we were going to go upstairs and there was we overloaded the elevator.
Yeah. Alcohol.
And so people still had drinks in their hands and they thought it was, yay, it's funny. And basically the elevator just stopped and we, you know, called the emergency, whatever. And the door was somewhat open between floors?
It was open between floors. And one tool decided that the clever thing to do would be to try and slide out. And it was still, the thing was moving.
Yeah, like, he could have been decapitated.
Yeah, that was a real... Yeah, that
really
was a real
bad idea.
And then I think I
think you and I were going, "Oh no, this is getting real."
We
had to calm people down.
Well,
right?
That's what I remember from it was that you and I had to basically come up with a way, and our way of keeping people's attention calm was to start taking selfies.
Right. Yes.
That was the way that we there are actually selfies somewhere online, which hopefully look like people are enjoying themselves, but it's actually just you and I panically distracting everyone.
Because I could see some people were about to get panicked, and when you're in a small space and you're like someone's about to go into a panic, goes, "Hey guys, let's take some selfies."
Yeah, we'll have to attach those selfies to this podcast, I think.
It was quite entertaining. Yeah. But I know I'm going to jump all over the place, but you're in town because you've lived here before, but let's figure out like, how did you end up living here? What's your origin story? We got to get to that.
Oh man, it's a real meanderer and I don't want to bore people senseless with,
sure they won't be bored.
So my background, I've done a range of different things from mm-hmm. concept art. I started out in 3D doing asset creation, for video games and, but I was always interested in illustration as a kid.
Yeah.
And I was pretty good at it.
Yeah.
So I started first by trying to, when I left college, I was doing illustration, but then I started studying animation and 3D animation,
okay.
which got me onto Max.
And where was that? Where were you going?
I was in Southampton, which is my hometown back in the UK.
Yeah.
And I started learning. I was very, very keen to learn as much as I could as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
Which meant that the course that I had joined the year after college in Southampton University, mm-hmm. I had spent the summer studying so hard that by the time I got there, it was self-evident that I'd kind of learned the curriculum. That didn't seem to make much sense.
Oh, so you were like, I'm going to get a head start. And then it turns out you learned everything.
Yeah, pretty much.
Right.
So then they offered me a teaching position, which mm-hmm. I thought was a bit weird.
Right off the bat. Huh?
Right off the bat. So then I moved. I took a year out and just kind of started learning concept art because I was really interested in science fiction and mm-hmm. Craig Mullins, big inspiration.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
So I thought I'd use the 3D to help with that pursuit. And then the next year I decided to have another stab at university just because living at home was getting a bit dull. And I went to another university in Bournemouth, which had a similar experience, but I just wanted to be around people with a similar interest.
Sure.
And then one of the teachers there was offered a position in Amsterdam. As an artist, as a CG artist.
Okay.
And he couldn't take it. So he just said, do you want to go to Amsterdam and take this job in my place, basically?
Okay.
So then I went to Amsterdam and started designing, well, not designing, but doing CG assets for like video games.
Okay.
And for a studio called Streamline Studios.
All right.
This was back in 2007.
Okay.
So I was about 20 at that point. And then, from there I met the guys that I would eventually, start a company with, which is, Henrik Boller, Floris Didden, and Tobias Manowitz, and we started a studio called Character,
okay.
Which is a concept art and IP development studio, which is now based in Berlin.
Okay.
So I met those guys through Streamline, and we started riffing together for Killzone, for Guerrilla Games, making kind of concept design and world building.
Yeah.
And then stop me at any point if this starts to get tedious.
No, keep going. I think people want to know this.
There's a kind of and then.
Yeah.
But now I'm going to add a but. So but.
But.
But. Having been doing it for a few years, I realized that there was a certain futility to a lot of what I was designing.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is that I was noticing that in the production pipeline, a lot of the creation or the creative process for IPs was kind of like, we'll just make stuff and then we'll kind of pick out the stuff that's cool.
Right.
And I started to get a little bit concerned that that isn't the ultimate reason that we make stuff, is just to randomly...
It's like making things that go into a china shop and they're plucking out the nice china that they want.
And- yeah. So I started to become, I'd always been a massive film fan.
Right, right.
And I'd always been aware of how great films affected me.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, well, this can't be the process that great creatives use to make things. Like, surely there's more direction than just
make things.
Make things.
Right.
So at some point with Character, we were working on a whole range of great stuff, and these comments are not aimed at any of the projects we were working on, but it was more of an intuition that there was more to learn outside of the production process. So after we moved to Berlin in 2011, set up a studio there, and we worked on Game of Thrones, and we won some Emmy Awards. And then I kind of got to a point, I was 23, 24 at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And my feeling was, well, the kind of the golden carrot that I'd been chasing, that in some respects had been achieved, and I was like, I'm not entirely sure where to go from here. So I left Character.
It is kind of hard when you kind of get the job you think is your dream job, and you're
and that seems to be a perpetual theme, is that I keep on moving between, hence the meandering, I keep on moving between disciplines.
Sure.
But each step is really fascinating for me. So I left Character in 2013, and I started studying psychology and mythology and metaphysics, which doesn't sound like it has any association with film, but it actually strangely does. And I started to become fascinated with how stories work. And then I started to make lectures about stories.
Yes.
And
I want to get to your Jurassic Park lecture, because I love that lecture.
Yeah.
But so we'll get to that one. Yeah, let's finish this.
So I left Character, and I went and did worked for Activision for Infinity Ward, and I became a level designer. So I designed for their game Infinite Warfare. I designed this big level called the Retribution, which is this multi-dimensional ship that is the core kind of hub of the game.
Oh, nice.
And it has all of these game mechanics in it and multiple vehicles, and it's like a space carrier.
Right.
So I worked on that, designed that, and then rolled into Blade Runner 2049 and did
production. How did that come about?
That came about through, I was in Berlin studying, and I was just taking a hiatus. And then a really good friend of mine who I met at IFCC in 2015, a guy called Chris Rosewarne. He's a prop designer and set designer in film.
Right.
Very kind of, experienced film designer. He had been offered the job on Blade Runner 2049, but he was on another film called Life. So he was doing concept design. So he just said to the production designer, well, you need this guy.
Wow.
So just by good fortune.
Right.
Obviously.
That's not your first film that you worked on, is it? As a concept artist.
I'd done Game of Thrones, but games had been my kind of bread and butter.
Sure.
By this point. But everything's transferable. And
yeah, absolutely.
And I knew in some respects, I knew more about film than I did about games, which is kind of an odd one.
Well, you had mentioned your passion, obviously, for film and for science fiction film.
Yes.
So this is yet again another dream job situation.
Yeah.
Yes, because it is Blade Runner 2049, which is amazing.
Yeah. And at first I had my hesitations, but I didn't know much about it, about the sequel. Mm-hmm. And then I just saw that it was Denis Villeneuve, and I checked out some of his movies before, and I was like, well, this should be amazing.
Yeah.
This could be incredible. So I got mega excited and then moved to Budapest and worked on that for a few months.
Okay.
And that was a real learning experience.
And what were some of the things you were designing?
I designed Kay's apartment, kitchen, the ceiling projector. I did a lot of animation work to show.
I saw the stuff that you did where it's the thing on the ceiling, which is the hologram that comes down.
Yeah,
right?
So it's, in the film, it's called the Emanator. I don't think they ever name it in the film, but it's behind the scenes, we called it the Emanator. And And my approach, there was that, and I designed Dr. Stelline's memory orb, which is another.
Yes.
So it's the kind of device that she uses to create memories.
Yeah.
Joy's
really beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
I was very pleased with that one.
It was really an interesting idea of how to physically operate this thing and what it would do.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a lot of...
did not seem trivial. It seemed very intentional in a sense.
That's great to hear because it was very intentional.
Yeah.
And there was quite a few layers to it that came from various directions, from Dennis, the production designer. And then I kind of had to coalesce some of the broad ideation into something that was functional and,
right.
and expressed a lot without being too attention seeking.
Sure.
And I was really pleased with the way that it came out, just because the prop master, Doug Harlocker, he took the animations that I built in 3D to express the behavior. And he actually got this guy from an aeronautics company to engineer real servo systems to reenact the actual CG prop. So
okay.
there's no CG with that prop. Everything you see on screen is an interactive prop with button control
so
servos.
It's a physical prop.
It's a physical prop.
Nice.
Yeah. So they really went to town on it, you know.
Nice.
And that's obviously very satisfying.
Now, did you based on you said you were studying psychology, obviously this thing is built to make memories. There's obviously some psychological aspect to it. Does any of that influence part of that design process or things that you were doing?
It does. it does. I won't go into, I always find it, well, first of all, contractually, I'm not allowed to talk about the creative ideation behind stuff.
Okay.
So I won't go into details that would be like that would be damaging to that. But also, I kind of feel like it's best when a designer doesn't discuss too much about the hidden stuff. In
oh
their
no!
Own.
I love
looking at other people's
I don't
stuff
wanna
and analyzing.
Act, yeah.
But,
I don't,
but
I
yes,
don't, so. I think it's actually more interesting just to say yes. Of course, it had an influence on
yeah.
it. But I also think it's wonderful to just try to imagine all the things that could be there. You
yeah.
know?
There is a lot of there were two things that kind of coalesced together that became quite complementary, which mm-hmm. was that I was taking concepts from my experience in CG, mm-hmm. which is that obviously Dr. Anna Stelline is doing the work of a CG artist. I mean, she's got
yes,
a handheld.
She's
object.
World building.
She's world building.
Yeah,
and obviously world building takes a lot of different controls and multidimensionality and a lot of
yeah. I mean,
there are so many aspects to even navigating a 3D space that an interface requires so much interaction. So it needed to be a multi-dimensional interface that had many, many dynamics to it.
Sure.
And then there was aspects of like temporal resolution, you know, if you want to slow down and speed up time and you want to slow, you know, increase and decrease resolution of what you're looking at. So the whole thing was designed to try and get those, the multi-dimensionality of what she's doing across in a very organic way.
Yeah.
Know, not too technical. It's not a keyboard. It's something more organic.
Sure.
But there are aspects of psychology in there as well, but I won't mention them too much. But it was interesting to bring those psychological and
right.
CG elements together and try and create something that's kind of got metaphorical value that hopefully sinks in unconsciously.
Okay.
And hopefully just sinks in without being too in your face, you know?
Yeah.
But I was very pleased with that one for sure. And it just seeing the final scene, I just think it's such a great scene.
Absolutely.
The dialogue, the acting, the sets.
So
it's just,
good.
It just works, you know.
So, you know, I still want to go over this device because it was fascinating to me and I was thinking a lot about it. I did another podcast with Alex McDowell, right, who's obviously famous for his world building stuff, as well as the stuff he's done on Minority Report, which is great. I still have a hard time with his interface on Minority Report. Everyone seems to love it, and to the point where now anyone doing anything in AR, all the customers always say, make it like Minority Report, right? Which is grandiose gestures, lots of movements, etc. And this is supposed to be the future interface at which you're reacting.
Mm.
What you designed and what it was so much more micro movements, which is way more natural, I think, in a lot of ways. I don't really... The thing I always say is like, if you actually made a Minority Report type interface, you would be exhausted after about 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Right? But with this device, it's not a keyboard, which is very traditional, right? Mm. But it's another type of small manipulation of your fingers that can permeate, you know, in so many different ways because you have so many, it's like a giant lock, you know, that you're unlocking all these different things. It was a really great idea and design. And I thought as an idea of creating a unique science fiction interface that you interact with. It was very unique. So really thought it was cool.
I appreciate that. Yeah. That's great to hear.
Yeah. I thought it was like relating to, you know, the world building and Alex works. Alex is amazing. I just have a problem with the Minority Report interface. I think it was beautiful. It works great in camera. Everyone gets very excited when they see it, but doesn't seem practical.
Yeah. I think it's that balance between, because I've had similar comments, in a negative sense, actually.
Interesting.
People critiking the design.
In a
constructive way.
Sure.
In a way where there was a basis for the critique. It wasn't just, you know, this is shit, which is, no one wants to hear that. Sorry, excuse my language.
That's okay.
And I did hear some interesting critique to do with the value system of the original film, to do with like how Ridley Scott used like voice activation and da-da-da.
Right.
And it's like, yeah, but you got to keep in mind that the scene itself has to carry certain things. So you're limited in the channels that you can use. So, for example, if you have to have a voice activated device, then the characters can't interact with each other because one's too busy talking to the device, you know?
Right.
So it's that kind of, there are specific reasons why you make certain design decisions. I do think I agree with you with the Minority Report design, but then I would also, my defense of it, and not that it needs defending, like as you know, because it's not a critique, it's just an observation, but it's like, I think that large expressionistic canvas that is there does allow the audience to emote with the kind of changing pace of Tom Cruise's interaction with it.
Absolutely.
The embodied expression, which is exhausting in reality.
Right.
If we didn't have that, it would be a less engaging scene. You know, when he starts to panic and he's trying to speed up things and he's moving around, his entire body is interfacing with this thing.
And as far as the narrative of the film, it is ideal and perfect.
Yeah.
But the problem is people look at that and say, I want that. And it's like
no,
you really?
You don't want that. Yeah.
Do you really?
Look, Tom Cruise is sweating while using it. Yeah. Trust me. You know, yeah. He's Tom Cruise.
Yeah. Yeah. And he works out.
Yeah. It's that trade-off between, you want the design to be, I talk about this in a lecture that's online about the two aspects that you want to have, which is you want a design to be logical enough that it passes by the conscious immune system of the viewer.
Right.
So that they don't go, this doesn't make sense.
Right.
And then once it's got past that immune system, you want it to be laced with theatricality that gets ideas across.
Sure.
So it's that careful balance between at what point do you break the audience's sense of believability? And if you break it, then it doesn't matter what metaphors you've got because they're like, this is stupid, you know?
Right.
And I think that's where the delicate balance is with production design is where can you pull those things as far apart as possible without them snapping like an elastic band.
Right.
You know, you want it to be as theatrical as possible, but still be believable. And sometimes those are in conflict, but you want to carefully get that tension right. You know, that's a tricky one.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly where I was going. I mean, a lot of things obviously that were designed, even in the original Blade Runner, you know, the machine that they were looking to detect people, the eye, like all of that stuff was like, yeah, it's beautiful, but it also looks like that's probably could be something I believe in, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's fascinating, you know, when you're looking at the eyes, obviously the eyes are so expressive, but here you're looking at it much more clinically in the original one, you know?
Yeah.
All of those ideas are really interesting.
Yeah.
For sure. Okay, so that's amazing. So having worked on that project, that's fairly recent, I guess.
Yeah, that was, I wrapped on that in 2016.
Okay.
And that's actually, it was after that project that I made a clear decision, very clear decision to start focusing on formalizing intuitions that I had. I wanted to be able to articulate things in a way that would be understandable to other people about what I thought was a pragmatic way to approach design and film.
Right.
So that's when I started to focus on the Jurassic Park lecture.
Mm-hmm.
I did a lecture about Terminator 2. And more recently, I've been doing some others. And I'm now kind of traveling and studying to build more of that material because from what I've gathered from feedback from people, I spent 10 years doing designs, but now most people kind of value the lectures that I give more than the designs, which I'm extremely happy about that.
Great.
I care about that material, you know?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, as you know, we've met a couple of times, but it came up on my newsfeed. It was a lecture you gave, I believe it was in Berlin for THU. That's where it was recorded.
Yeah.
And it was you making an argument between Jurassic Park and Jurassic World.
Yes.
And I've always had that problem. And it was really hard for me to figure out how to express it. And that I 100% agree with everything you said in that lecture. But you expressed it better than I could ever think about. So is there a way you can give a synopsis of that? I would love to put it online with the, with the, with the podcast notes, but give a synopsis of the idea.
I'll try and give the synopsis in as few lines as possible. Great films that stick with us and stick with multiple demographics and multiple age groups. They stick with us because they address an archetypal issue, which is an archetypal issue is anything that is of universal importance to everyone.
Right.
So the idea that I proposed, and I stand by it stronger than ever over the last couple of years since I made that lecture, was that the reason Jurassic Park is successful is because it's actually an allegory. And it's an allegory, which an allegory is a metaphorical story that represents an abstract idea.
Okay.
And the abstract idea that it represents, and there's plenty of evidence within the film structure to suggest it was intentional by the screenwriter David Koepp and Michael Crichton, is that they saw an opportunity to turn the subject of creating dinosaurs on an island using genetic engineering as a device to express the journey into becoming parents.
So, yes.
Because the abstraction of creating life is one of the big questions. Can you be responsible for life? That's a big theme in the whole film. Mm-hmm. Can you control life? And no. That's another theme of chaos versus control. Mm-hmm. And one of the other reasons that I've only since found out this was the case was that when Steven Spielberg, and this is a running theme in many of his films, the idea of parenthood and the absent father being a big theme because of in his childhood, he had the concept of an absent father for a certain period. When he approached Michael Crichton to make Jurassic Park as a movie, Michael Crichton was going to be the guy that actually adapted the book to the screenplay.
Yep.
He explicitly said that the characterization needed to change because in the book, Alan Grant is already a big hit with the kids and he loves kids.
Right.
And Spielberg basically said, well, I want to make this film, but it's not going to work unless we have this huge arc.
Right.
Which is that how do we take this couple where one is ready to have children, and that's subtextually embedded in not only the dialogue at the beginning of the film where Ellie and Alan discuss the little fat kid that insults the raptors.
Yeah.
Or the raptor bones. But throughout the structure of the film, even using cinematography framing, it expresses the changing relationship of Alan and Ellie as they're confronted with this journey through the park.
Right.
And by the end, they're both on the helicopter symmetrically from the beginning of the film where they were going into the island with this conflict of interest. Mm-hmm. And then when they're returning back from the island, Alan has the two kids in his arms and she's looking at him and they both look out the window to the birds flying next to them.
Right.
And the discussion at the beginning of the film is birds evolved from dinosaurs and Alan has evolved into a family member from an individual, which is why he's categorized as the intellectual lone raptor, which is why he carries around the raptor claw. Mm-hmm. And by the time he's mastered his, in mythology, called inner dragon, which is contemporized in the form of a Tyrannosaurus Rex instead of a dragon, as it would be in fantasy, by the time he's mastered that inner dragon, he's mastered his instincts and he's learned that the emotional aspect of himself.
Right.
And the whole story is an allegory of that, which is why there's only a handful of special effects scenes and there's only 950 shots in the whole film.
Right.
But across the course of that film, each shot is tailor-made to be symbolic of this archetypal growth, which a child will understand from the perspective of knowing what they want from a protective parent figure.
Yep.
Adults understand from the perspective of responsibility for themselves, their partners, their
and
children.
And also fear of responsibility.
And fear of responsibility. Yep. And even grandparents can watch it because they've been through this whole journey themselves.
Right.
So the reason that it tapped into to this large viewer base is because it's tapping into something fundamental and it's using dinosaurs as a device. And my argument was that Jurassic World is to excuse my language, but it's just shit.
Yeah, it is.
It's just a load of very impressive VFX dinosaurs. And the reason that it just doesn't affect us in any way is because it has no concept of what it's trying to say.
Right, because people look at Jurassic Park without thinking about the fact that they've actually experienced an extremely complex character development that they can relate to.
Yeah.
But they remember the dinosaurs. So yeah. When they make Jurassic World, they just made dinosaurs.
Yes. Yeah.
And there is no character development.
Yes, absolutely. And this is where it comes down to qualitative versus quantitative.
Right.
When you've got entire corporate entities that run on marketing data and focus groups, then they're going to pick up on quantifiables, which is like, well, if they look at the trajectory of the amount of VFX shots between movies and the profit margins between movies, they're going to extrapolate that more VFX shots means more profit. So they'll make that an agenda. They'll say, well, we need more dinosaurs, because that's clearly...
But isn't that a little bit ironic?
Because it's a forced correlation.
It's a little bit ironic because the plot of Jurassic World is also about that too.
Yeah. I think there was an attempt by the writers to have some sort of a meta reference to the nature of the film industry.
Right.
Which I get, and that's cute, blah, blah, blah. But it's a very, very idiosyncratic, specific thing that only people in film really care about.
But it doesn't, yeah, it doesn't solve the problem of the film.
Yes, right? It doesn't. It's almost like a sort of throwing your hands in the air, which I get, because, you know, these big machines that make these films, they're not, you can't, unless you're Spielberg, you can't navigate them in a way where you get a signal in there. It's just noise. But the quantifiable stuff is what the film studios are referencing.
Right.
But they don't know, they know quantitative, but they don't know qualitative. And qualitative is much more difficult to grasp. And that's why I said about making these lectures, because I don't think qualitative is impossible to grasp. I just don't think that we have the terminology or the language or the clarity to be able to make a case for qualitative over quantitative to the decision makers.
Sure.
So my goal is, well, look, if you're a producer and you want to make a shitload of money, then if you adhere to these things, these moral principles about storytelling, not only will you please the audience, you'll make more money. Mm-hmm. So it's a win-win. There is zero benefit in continuing this pursuit of quantitative, apart from exhausting the audience and eventually killing their trust in your brand.
Right.
And that's what's happening with these films right now. There's franchise fatigue, and that's because the franchises, for the most part, there are exceptions, of course, but they're stressing people's nostalgia out. They're just taking they're taking the theme tune, and people are going back in there with the emotional resonance of what they experienced 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And then they're being abused. You know, and for the most part, because people generally go along with the hype machine and the reviews, and those reviews are, let's face it, corrupt. A lot of the mainstream reviews aren't necessarily reflective of the reality of the film. It's just, you know, it's the velvet hammer. People are convinced that it's good because everyone else is saying it's good. It's that kind of, yeah, that was good, wasn't it? Like, and you watch people walk out the screening kind of like with this unenthused, oh, that was good, wasn't it? You know, and like, just this kind of, it's almost
they don't want to admit the fact that it wasn't good.
Yeah.
Because they feel that if they say it wasn't good, they would admit that what their nostalgia was.
Yes.
Was not good.
It's a very weird conflict of interest.
Basically saying that was crap, meaning, well, then your childhood was crap because I just showed you your childhood and that was crap. But that's not true.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Okay.
So what I was trying to do with the Jurassic Park talk, and my aim is, I had to cram it into 20 minutes at THU.
Which I think is great, because then you can be all prepared for your TED Talk on it.
what I really want to do next, and I really feel like
By the way, you succeeded in that 20 minutes. You gave.
That's really great. I'm really happy about that. But I've studied that film more than I can possibly express. I could do a 2-hour lecture on that. And I think the whole 2-hour lecture would be pretty fascinating to people, because the amount of things, the cascading effects of that theme and how they're applied at every level of the film is, for me, the epitome of craft.
Right.
So once you've got that theme in mind, and then you go through every scene and the structure and the cinematography and the lighting and the dialogue, the settings, the structural symmetries, it's all crafted to reinforce this allegorical theme.
Right.
And I've spoken to people that apparently were close to the production that said, that's not there. But I just fundamentally disagree, because because Spielberg asked the screenwriter to embed these things by default, and B, because there are so many clearly blatant aspects of that theme that are connected to every point of the film. And I believe it would be useful from a film design perspective. I mean, there are thousands of people coming into the film industry seemingly every week.
Sure.
If we could just simply have a clear understanding of, a really clear understanding of one masterwork like Jurassic Park, that could change the course of how we make these movies. So I'm thinking, even though I sound like a broken record now, I'm thinking about revisiting that and really expanding upon it. Because, for example, one of the greatest scenes in the movie, and is absolutely explainable, but it's also the dullest scene, is the lunch scene. Where they discuss whether it's a good idea to run the park at all, which is where they're having lunch.
Oh, right, yes.
Hammond is, it's a conflict between, not a conflict, but between Malcolm, Chaos Theory, between the lawyer, who's obviously interested exclusively in profits.
Right.
And then there's Alan, who's on the fence about just how predictable you can, you know, he's in the middle, and so is Ellie. Mm-hmm. And John thinks that the scientists are going to be enthusiastic, but they're the ones that aren't.
Right.
And
I thought you'd be on my side.
Thought you'd be on my side, right. You know. Yeah, the quote is, you know, the blood-sucking lawyer or whatever, you know, yeah. The only person that's on my side is the blood-sucking lawyer.
Right.
And the guy says, thanks. But that from a production design point of view, that is one of the most masterful scenes. And it's masterful because there are so many aspects that people don't realize they're being influenced by.
Right.
For one, there's the metaphor of projection.
Right.
So what does each character project in the future as an outcome of this park? Now, inside the room, they're all surrounded by projectors, and there's a projector screen behind each character.
Yep.
If you watch the film again, the content of the projections is explicitly there to show what's going on in the mind of the character that's talking.
Oh, wow. I'll have to rewatch it.
And
yeah.
The only character that has no projection behind him is Malcolm, because he's chaos.
Right.
He's saying, you can't make a plan, so don't bother.
Right.
Now, behind the lawyer is pie graphs and estimations of profit.
Right.
Behind Hammond is pictures of beaches and families and aircraft taking off on holiday.
Right.
Behind Ellie is pictures of, I shit you not, actual cells, like as in egg cells, as in right. ovary cells
right.
and plant life.
Yeah.
And behind Alan is pictures of similar things because they're both science.
Right.
But the actual content of the projection screen changes depending on the tone.
Right.
So at one point, once the lawyer is insulted, when it cuts back to him, the projection behind him is a picture of the earth burning. And then when it cuts back to John Hammond, when he's talking about the validity of the park, it cuts to pie charts.
Right.
So it goes from being about family holidays to pie charts.
Right.
And then at the point where Malcolm is basically challenging Hammond,
right.
One of the most iconic scenes is when Malcolm says, what you call progress, I call the rape of the natural world.
Right.
And during that scene, the only thing behind him is this bright projector light, which is just behind him.
Right.
Which is glaring the camera lens, and it's obscuring everything, because what he's basically saying is it's a metaphor. Like,
right.
I'm obscuring your projection of the future with this claim. You know, and these are very, very subtle things, but you feel them. You know,
yeah.
You feel even the positioning of the cameras changes across the course of the scene as the debate gets more heated.
Right.
That one scene you could break apart, and it could become an absolute case study for film students across the world.
Wow.
You know, and that's where the masters are working. You know, and
right.
Spielberg might not necessarily say to the producers, "This is what I'm doing right now," mm-hmm. but he's certainly doing something, and it's working along these patterns.
Sure.
Which to me is, and this comes down to a big debate is whether this is conscious on the part of the creators, and a lot of people question that.
Right.
And I don't think that there's a subject called authorial intent, which is about, Christopher Nolan talks about it a little bit, which is that, is the author aware of the themes that they have in their book or not?
Right.
And the question is, the answer is, it doesn't matter. If they're there, they're there.
Right.
In the same way that an individual is not aware of most of their repressed qualities, most of their repressed qualities is what shows up in their daily life, you know? So most of the way that we behave is based upon a lot of stuff that we have no conscious access to.
Right.
Our childhood memories, et cetera, et cetera. Which is why there's a consistent theme in all of Spielberg's work, which is the absent father. And all of his films are about, you know, even Hook is just about the father losing touch with his kids. Mm-hmm. With E.T., the first three quarters of the movie, there is not a single adult male that shows up in the movie as an actual figure. They only ever show up as below the waistline figures, because there is no father figure for Elliot.
Right.
Which is why he creates this projection of a friend that will take him through the experiences that a father should take him through.
Right.
You know, dealing with girls, taking responsibility for himself, drinking beer.
Right.
Feeling other people's feelings, empathy.
Right.
This all comes through E.T. Mm-hmm. because there's no father figure. And it's only in the third quarter of the film when Keyes shows up. And Keyes shows up and becomes the father figure by the end of the story, where he bonds with the mother. And that's a setup at the beginning of the film, which is explicitly set up when they talk about the absent father being in Mexico with Sally. So these, and in fact, the very last thing that, and this is called the inciting incident, the inciting question is, in great stories, the major theme of the story is actually told and usually told verbally. So that at the point at the beginning of the movie, for those of you who are E.T. fans, the inciting question that dictates the theme of the entire story is when Michael, Elliot's big brother, after Elliot insults the mother about how the dad's gone off to Mexico with Sally, he says something really cruel, and the mother gets up and goes to the sink, and she's holding back tears. Mm-hmm. And Michael says to him, Elliot, when are you going to grow up and learn to basically feel how others feel? like to have feelings,
empathy.
Right. And at that point, Elliot then goes out into the garden, and then he finds E.T. And right. E.T., who is E.T.? E.T. is someone that he shares feelings with.
Right.
So that's a thematic concept that right. comes directly off the back of an argument about where is the father.
Right.
You know, so you look at these things closely enough, they're not coincidental. They're very tightly laced together.
Yeah.
So I've gone off on a tangent there. I probably should
stop. No, it's great. It's great. There's another thing that really bothers me about the arguments about Jurassic Park and Jurassic World. I think there's a lot of people who, on a surface level, agree that Jurassic Park is a better movie than Jurassic World. But the thing that always bothered me is that they you explained exactly why I think it's a better film. But everyone else seems to say, well, it's like, no, Jurassic Park was better because it was practical effects.
And oh, man.
Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. And this is another one of those surface level.
They don't understand because, first of all, the effects in Jurassic World are fantastic. Mm-hmm. They're really good. And there's no reason to knock the quality of the effects on there. That's not what's the problem.
No, it's not the problem. It's like it's like looking at a surface attribute and then creating a diagnosis from it. And it's a false diagnosis. And to be fair to the producers of Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom, because they actually believe that's what the fans care about, because that's what people said,
right?
They did make a big song and dance in the latest film about how they've changed to practical effects instead of VFX because they thought the fans liked it. And it's like, I respect the fact that they attempted to make a change towards something that
wasn't a better film, though.
But it wasn't a better film. It's like, you're putting lipstick on a pig, you know, it's like, don't bother, you're completely seeing the wrong issues here.
To me, it was mostly about the character development. There was no character development. You know, there were kids in this movie in Jurassic World.
Yeah.
And the one that really just kind of made me burst out laughing was when he's complaining that they're seeing a lawyer, they're going to get a divorce. It's like, I didn't even know you had parents.
I don't
even care about you at all. As a person or anything, these are vapid, empty characters that serve absolutely no purpose.
And
there is nothing to be said about that. Anyway, really, really cool. And I think it seems like you've really sort of taken a niche to understanding this and putting these things into words.
I've put a lot of time and effort into this. I think if people see the talks and it looks like it's natural, that's great because it's been a lot of effort.
Well, I think you've structured something very well here, which is cool.
Oh, thank you.
Now, you're still continuing to do concept art as well, obviously.
Yeah. Okay. It's still my bread and butter. So my job description has changed drastically over the last couple of years. Since the talks, I've actually been working as a consultant on certain things where I've helped studios communicate and express through story their kind of goals and so what, for example, one of the things that I worked on recently is I worked with Blur and I worked as a brand consultant. So
okay.
I developed if you guys have seen Love, Death and Robots.
Oh yeah.
I was I headed up the brand strategy.
Oh nice.
Which is how it communicates the ideology of the symbols, how that reflects the show and its kind of very idiosyncratic nature.
Right.
And helping distill down what the values are of that show. Because it's now that it's out and about, you know, everyone knows what it is and everyone can feel its kind of internal consistency, mm-hmm. despite the fact that it's 18 short stories of random content. Like when I say random content, there's no thematic thread that goes through all of them.
Right.
And obviously that's before it was launched, it was like, well, how do we communicate this show in a way that's kind of natural and kind of it represents it, but at the same time, we can't reference any one particular show as a representation of the whole series.
Sure.
Because if you focus on one, then you exclude 17 others. And if you focus on another, you exclude the others. And you want to come up with a way to communicate to the audience that this is going to be pretty random and there's going to be lots of stuff. So it was about strategizing even like the symbology and the icons and how they move and the interchangeability of content, the tonality, the irreverence, all of that had to be carefully kind of considered. Mm-hmm. So I helped, I worked with Blur and Netflix to develop something similar to the lectures where I created presentations and brand strategy videos that expressed how the show would express itself.
Awesome.
So that's like one other avenue of what I'm up to at the moment. It's always helpful to have concept art on your side to be able to just rough out things, you know?
Yeah, of course.
So it's, but I, yeah, concept art I still do. I've just wrapped up on Dune, Denis Villeneuve's new film.
I'm so excited about this.
Yeah, so am I.
Oh my gosh. Okay, don't.
Obviously, I can say zero.
You can say zero. You can say zero, but I can say that I'm extremely excited about it. I think, obviously, Dune, I'm not necessarily the David Lynch version is a great one, but I don't think that it's I think the last half of it is not as good as the first half of it, right? And then it's like, if they're going to redo this thing, they have to redo it some way that makes sense. And you need a really good director. And after 2049, I'm like, oh, this could be really, really good. I was going to ask you, it's like, since you worked on 2049, are you working on Dune? Which obviously makes sense. That's very exciting. Very exciting.
Yeah.
And When's the release date on that approximately?
I think it's November next year.
Okay.
I think it's a while.
So they're shooting now.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Awesome. As far as I know, I left just at the beginning of shooting. So I was in Budapest for a little bit. So.
Okay. All right. And then obviously you're going to continue doing lectures. Obviously you've been doing lectures all around the world now, and you're doing more concept art. What is, so now that you've gone through this journey, you've expressed how you've gone through all these different little phases. Did you think of yourself as doing these lectures ever? Or did this sort of happen like, hey?
They were partly strategic.
Okay.
I knew from experience that, I'm not a political person. And what I mean by political is that I can't navigate the political systems of productions very well. So I knew that the only way that I was going to get these ideas across was to circumnavigate the hierarchy rather than work my way up through it. So my logic was, well, if I believe I know these things and I believe I can explain them, then I should put my money where my mouth is and make an attempt at that. And if it works, then, you know, perhaps it will have an effect, or it will be visible to people that could actually allow me to implement these ideas.
So going back to, you know, what you were talking about earlier when you were, you know, first, just doing concept art and creating assets, and you were frustrated because people were just picking and choosing what they wanted, right? And you knew that there was a bigger goal out there to do something. Did you find that instead of actually trying to tell people, executives, about this, you might as well just put it out there as a lecture instead and then see if people understand what you're trying to say?
I have noticed that there is it's been more complicated than I anticipated to communicate these ideas outside of a lecture. Because the thing about a lecture is that not only do you have the opportunity to really get your thoughts in order and really come up with a concise delivery, but there's also the strange effect psychologically that people are much more, they tend to be much more interested in what you have to say when there's already another audience that's invested. So in other words,
give me an example. Yeah.
Well, let me give you an example. Like, you will always tend to listen to the person that already has an existing base of followers than you will to listen to a random person in the bar that says he's an expert.
Yes.
Because, you know, there's the bar philosopher and then there's the person that seems to have credibility through having proven it.
Right.
So people tend to be swayed by the public aspect of a lecture. And when you have to go into a meeting room and describe this on a much less, what's the word, dramatic and kind of
controversial way.
Yeah. When you just go in there and discuss it, and it's a lot of work for people because you're asking them to think about something and you're not laying it all out on a plate. And that means that sometimes you don't get the idea across as cleanly as you would like, or even if you do get the idea across relatively cleanly, maybe they just aren't interested.
Sure.
So I've learned to recognize that, there's different ideologies as well. You know, some people think in a completely different way that's different to me. So I'm kind of learning about how to adapt the communication, but I think that for me, it seems that the biggest impact these things have had is on people that are really interested in learning. And that to me seems like the long game might be more interesting, is instead of trying to persuade people that are currently positioned in power, which is a hard task to achieve.
Right.
It might be more beneficial to help the next generation of people that are coming up that will be embedded in this structure from the beginning, you know? So I'm kind of thinking about whether I really care about this subject. Like, I've spoken about this before, but I don't think people understand quite how important stories are, to shaping the individuals and therefore society. And I spent a lot of time reading in psychology the impact of mythology and stories on people's value systems. Yeah. You know, the stories we tell each other are the stories that dictate what we consider to be right and wrong.
Right.
Which is why Jurassic World was such a toxic film for me, because the moral lessons that a child who hasn't been taught properly by a responsible adult, the moral lessons they take away from Jurassic World is you can be rich and in a position of power. You can sacrifice people's lives because you're worried about your company's profit margins. At the end, when all these people that you were responsible for that paid you money get killed in refugee camps, you walk off into the sunset with the good-looking model.
Right.
That's the lesson that you take away from Jurassic World. Not least of all, she didn't give a flying fuck about the fact that her assistant died yeah. after she had tasked her wrongly with looking after two bratty kids that was not part of her job description. It's like the whole thing was just broken.
Yeah.
The moral takeaway is that bad people will get away with things. And maybe that's some quirky meta thing that the writers thought. I don't think it is.
I don't think it is. I think it's just sloppy morals. Yeah.
Sloppy morality.
Sloppy writing too.
It's sloppy writing, you know. And you look at the original Jurassic Park, it's a way more interesting film overall, but the actual characterization of Dennis Nedry, you know, it describes this man that never grew up. He's self-interested. He's a child. You know, he's envious and gluttonous. Mm-hmm. He steals stuff. He puts people in danger, and then he suffers the consequences.
Right.
Same with aliens when it comes to Burke.
Right.
Now people think, well, but that's formulaic. You've got to change up the formula. I said, no, we've been telling these stories for thousands of years.
Right.
People are satisfied by the nuanced characterization of a moral tale.
Right.
You know, morality doesn't get old, you know.
Yep.
So when you fail to apply morality to a film, you get a soul-deadening experience. And that's what people come away from. They come away feeling numb.
Right. And I think that's what's also a misconception is that a popular film that's enjoyed by the, you know, doesn't have to be Chinatown or something really complicated, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. I'm going to rephrase that. The way that you described everything that was going on in Jurassic Park, you know, it could have been like a Wim Wenders film, right? Mm. But it wasn't. It was a Steven Spielberg film that everyone was approachable. It was approachable to everyone. A Wim Wenders film is not approachable by everyone. Yeah. So you can still get a really strong moral construction, character-built story narrative that is completely approachable. And even though you may not consciously be aware of everything that's going on, you are still completely invested in this film and have a great experience.
Yeah.
And so I think that if you're going to invest all this money into a film, there's no reason to ignore that basis of story.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Because otherwise it's like more visual effects, more dinosaurs, that's what everyone likes. It's like, that's not what everyone it's subconsciously everything else was there.
Yes, I can give you a great example.
Okay.
With Jurassic Park. Now, hopefully this will lead to an aha moment for people that are listening. The big overarching theme in all of Spielberg's movies is that moral responsibility is a good thing. So you want to take moral responsibility. So we have Alan, and he needs to take moral responsibility for the children. So that manifests in the big scene where he's confronted with a giant dinosaur that is over the top of the car, and he finds this flare. Mm-hmm. He lights it up, which is symbolic of him finding his instincts. Mm-hmm. He then swings the flare in front of this giant beast that could easily eat him. He takes on that strength and that courage, and then he throws like throwing a dog a bone. He throws the flare away.
Yeah,
and then because of this courageous act, the fate has it that the dinosaur, the big beast, runs away from the children and runs away from Alan. So the act of courage leads to this outcome. That's one lesson. Mm-hmm. Now, what Spielberg does, which people don't realize, is that he does a binary opposite without people consciously knowing it, which is that when Nedry crashes his car while he's trying to steal stuff from the park, and he has no responsibility for anyone but himself,
right?
He crashes his car and he goes down a hill to try and tie the cable to a tree to get himself out of the pickle. Yeah. And he comes across a very, very tiny T-Rex.
Right.
And what he does is, in his act of self-interest, he picks up a stick and reenacts what Alan does. He shakes the stick and he throws it.
Uh-huh.
And this little creature, which is half his size, looks blankly at what he's done, looks back at him, and then decides he's going to kill him.
Right.
The moral takeaway from this is that what Spielberg is saying is one character takes moral responsibility and does one thing that's exactly the same as the other character, but the other character's a monster.
Right.
And he dies. Now, the similarity of the scene structure is not a coincidence.
Nope.
It's showing these are binary comparisons.
Right.
Look at these two people. This is a little man against a big monster and he wins. This is a big fat man against a little monster and he loses.
Right.
What's the difference? Morality.
Yeah.
Courage. Responsibility.
Yep.
That's unconsciously embedded in there and we feel it.
Right.
You know? And it's a mythological motif that the monster is often blind to his own self-interest because of his own self-interest. And the last thing that happens with Nedry is he loses his glasses.
Right.
And he says, oh, I don't need the glasses. I'm rich. I'll buy new ones. And the last thing that happens to him is he's blinded by poison because monsters are often blind because they don't see the way that somebody who's good and moral sees, who sees the light.
Yeah.
So there's hidden motifs there. And when you look at the structure of the scenes, it's the same as with the eggs. The car is an egg that births the children.
Right.
And the eggs that they then later find, the motif of the footsteps away from the broken shell of the car and the broken shell of the eggs is a motif. It's a symmetrical motif. It's binary.
Yes. Now, I still want to go back to your responsibility in this situation, because I think that there is something that you do that is really insightful when you're bringing up these subjects in the lectures that you do. Somehow there's a bunch of people that go up on YouTube and say, the reason Jurassic World sucked is because they used too many visual effects or too much CGI, as they say. And that's wrong. It's incorrect diagnosis. But yet the studios responded to that. So why can't they listen to your argument and do the same thing?
I think I have an answer. And it comes down to that same fundamental reality that people are more swayed when they see an existing base of followers, especially studios who are looking to maximize profits. So, for example, I simply don't have as much viewership as somebody that creates you look at somebody that creates one of those very, very, what's the word, controversial, outlandish, outspoken clickbait videos.
Sure.
They're going to get millions of views.
Right.
Now, what they're saying could be absolute rubbish, but the millions of views will be enough to sway somebody in marketing because they'll be like, well,
that's enough people.
They'll say the audience is correct. And if the audience is larger for this video, then that's what we should follow.
Right.
But because my videos aren't necessarily that, they're not as much fun to watch. I try to make them as engaging as possible, but ultimately I'm still asking people to think. And most people in general don't really want to think that much.
Like, right.
They think they do. They say they do. But once you actually see them try and put in the legwork of working this stuff out, they give up pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So I think it comes down to, Maybe what I'm saying might have more effect if I had more viewers, but I'm not good at engineering that, and I think that the content hopefully over time will speak for itself.
Yes,
but I have no idea how to engineer viewership, you know, and I don't want to.
Well,
put the time
there's
into
ways
it.
To do that. There are ways to do that that I think are interesting, and I'll we can talk about it. Maybe if you have time, we can grab some lunch after this, and I can tell you more about it. But there are ways to engineer that. The problem is that when often you end up trying to say things to try to gain more of an audience, at which point sometimes you go against what you're trying to do.
Yes.
So you have to be very, very careful about this.
Yes. Yeah. And that's something that I've kind of caught myself in the act of, you know, oh, maybe I should say something, you know, more insulting here or something.
And
it takes an element of self-control to go, well, that's the easiest route.
No, I think you need to be yourself.
Yeah. And I'm still, as with everyone, still working out what myself is. But I'm trying to maintain that level of, okay, the content should never be sacrificed on the altar of viewership, you know?
Right.
So I'm trying to maintain some integrity as much as I can, which is why I don't release much content, because most of the time it's like, this isn't good enough to share.
Right.
So I think my next lecture will be on Mad Max Fury Road.
Okay.
I was thinking about doing a big analysis of that and using it to explain psychology. I think one of the things that I think is happening.
Are you in town a week from today?
I can be.
Okay. I have an idea. You should be on my other podcast.
Oh, I'm in.
Called Martini Giant.
All right.
And,
are there martinis involved?
They can be. Yes.
Yes.
It's my friend Dan Thron and Eric Sheely and I, and we talk about films.
All right.
A lot.
Yeah, I'm in.
We're going to be talking, I think on Tuesday, we're going to be recording Thunderbolt and Lightfoot, Michael Cimino's film, 1974, Clint Eastwood, Jeff Bridges, road film, really crazy.
Cool.
Okay. So, but everything you've said, I've actually recorded episodes. We did one on Jurassic Park where we talked about very similar things. We did a really great one on Mad Max as well. We talked about that. So everything you're talking about, I think you'll totally fit into this. It'll be great.
Nice. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah, because I think, yes, Mad Max to me, the first Mad Max is so surreal, so interesting. Fury Road, I actually have a bit of an issue with Fury Road. Dan Thrawn absolutely loves it. It is one of his favorite films.
Can I admit something?
Yeah.
I haven't seen any of the other Mad Maxes.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I tried watching the first one, and I'll be honest, I just couldn't get through it.
It's weird.
Yeah. So I was just like, this film is very strange. You know, maybe it's just a sign of how rigid I am with what I watch, but okay. Maybe I should dig in and really have another go at it.
You can. I mean, or not. It's what you want to do, right? I've never, I always have arguments with Dan Thrawn because he loves Titanic. He saw it 25 times in a row in theaters.
Mm.
And I've never seen it.
That's quite special.
That is quite special. So I don't want it, so it is an interesting thing. But yeah, I love sort of getting down to the bottom of films and understanding that. I think it's a really great thing to think about these things, because I'd love people to understand that their films are more than what people think they are.
Oh God, people don't understand the impact that stories have.
Right.
You know, I use the anecdote of on an individual basis, how a story can shape people. Like when I was younger, my dad took myself and my older sister to go and see Hook.
Yeah.
Which, let's face it, it's not really a great film. Even yep. Spielberg has admitted, I think on the premiere night when he got into the limo after the premiere, he cried.
Mm.
He said that he saw it for the first time with an audience and realized
it wasn't what he wanted.
Good.
Yeah.
But the themes that are running that film, that which he delivers with the hammer blow, is the concept of the father losing contact with his kids because he prioritizes work over seeing the ball game
mm-hmm.
and spending time with them and being playful. Mm-hmm. And he has this cell phone attached to him at all times, which back in the day was a big thing
because
it's like 93.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad explained recently that when he was in that film with us watching that movie, while we were watching, you know, guys in spandex and tights flying around, he had a crystal clear realization, which is that I'm never going to miss a sports event of my children.
Yeah.
And he never did. Now, that story, good or not, as an actual construction, delivered a moral message to him, or it allowed him to visualize the consequences of behavior that could be regrettable.
Yeah.
And he changed his course of action for life. And that positively affected not only his life, but it affected
your life
indefinitely, my life and my sense of trust in, you know, this parent being this consistent theme. And it's like these are why we tell stories. Like they're embedded, the hidden meaning of these stories, it affects people and it codes people, it helps them codify their behavior. As another example, Adolf Hitler was a massive fan of a book called Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and the mm-hmm. subtext was the Jewish peril.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a piece of shitty fiction that stipulated that there was a Jewish conspiracy to take over the world at the expense of the German people,
right?
And this book he codified into his very nature, and it turned into concentration camps and gas chambers. You know, it's right. Like there are different amplifications of the results, but they all stem from the same seeds, which is that the stories we internalize and that we learn from,
mm-hmm.
we turn them into consequences.
Yes.
Which is why I feel so alarmed by the amount of shite that goes through the cinemas at the moment that kids are watching. And there's no, you know, if some corporate executive went up to a child and expressed verbatim the moral message that's in the film as a piece of direct, you know, he just stated it outright, which is you can be bad kid, you can do what you want, you can, as long as you make money and blah, 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 which is the message of Jurassic World,
right?
You get away with anything. We would say, well, this guy should at least be removed from being contacting with children.
Right.
You know, possibly this is a legal issue, you know, if you start pummeling these ideas into a child. But if that gets put into a product that reaches millions of children, there's no consequences. It's like, you know, that to me that's one of those strange...
Is very disturbing.
Yeah. I mean, this sounds like a moral tirade now. You know, obviously people they're not doing this intentionally. This isn't some conspiracy to make the world a worse place. But it doesn't change the fact that the world is kind of in a slippery slope right now, as we see politically, socially, trust between factions inside of the same tribe is dissolving.
Yep.
And I think it largely comes down to the family structures are diminishing and the stories we tell about family structures aren't as reinforcing as they used to be. And
sure.
Trust between groups is diminishing because of polarization. all of this can, you can see the trend of this happening across narratives over the last 50 years.
Yeah.
You know, these stories have changed, and so are the people that are watching them. You know? So it's a big thing in anthropology. There's a huge study about the importance of stories.
Yeah.
It's a massive subject, you know?
Okay.
It sounds academic, and it is. So I'll stop now. But
It's great. Well, we've just over an hour, but I think this has been a fascinating conversation. I think people really need to do this. I know your time is precious because you got another meeting, so I want to make sure we have time to grab a quick bite. But thanks so much for doing this. It's amazing. I think people should.
Thank you.
Where could people follow you now?
I'm on Instagram, mikehill.design. I'm now trying to keep that updated.
Sure.
I'm trying to keep it regular.
Yeah.
I've got a website, which I haven't updated in a long time, which is also mikehill.design. And then I'm on ArtStation as well, which is where you can find my concept art.
Great.
And then just Google Mike Hill film, film design for YouTube, and you'll find my YouTube channel, which has all my lectures on it.
Awesome. Well, that's great. Thanks so much, Mike. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Chris.